ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 20th of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. A deal between Labor and the Coalition to pass the government's hate speech laws appears within reach, but negotiations are down to the wire. The Liberal Party has agreed to a list of changes to the proposed reforms, with the Prime Minister declaring today is the deadline for them to pass. Political reporter Romy Stevens filed this story.
Jenny Reuter's uncle, Boris Tettelroyd, was one of the 15 victims of the Bondi terror attack. She has this message for the country's leaders.
Take off the politician hat and put on the human hat. We want the safe and happy and thriving Australia that we once had.
Today, the federal government's legislation designed to combat anti-Semitism and extremism in the wake of the tragedy will be introduced to Parliament. There will be two bills, one with laws targeting gun control. The other will introduce hate speech laws that have been stripped back from what the government originally put forward. Jenny Reuter's raised concerns about the legislation.
If they want to do new gun laws, do new gun laws, but don't rope it in to this very serious issue. The issue at hand is extremism of all forms, whether it be extremist Islam, radical Islam, neo-Nazis, the radical left. All of those are issues that are fueling anti-Semitism.
Would you like to see the legislation pass?
I would like to see a legislation that tackles the issues at hand rather than made up issues and deflected issues.
The gun laws are set to pass with support from the Greens. However, the minor parties ruled out backing the hate speech laws. That's left the government to negotiate with the opposition. It's understood the Liberal Party has agreed to several changes to the legislation. They include stronger aggravated offences, so all extremist preachers and leaders are covered by the laws, and a requirement that the opposition leader is consulted on the listing and delisting of extremist groups. However, the Nationals are still working through the details. Party leader David Littleproud says it's complex policy work.
There are elements that we want to support, but there are other elements that obviously we have serious issues about, so we're trying to be reasonable, we're trying to be constructive, but we haven't got a lot of time because of the time frame in which the Prime Minister's put on us.
Changes to hate speech and gun reforms were not expected to be on the government's agenda until the Bondi attack, meaning these laws have been written in weeks rather than the usual months or years. Associate Professor in Politics at the Australian National University, Jill Shepherd, says as someone who typically takes pride in not being hasty, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's been forced to act quickly. However, she doesn't expect that to have significant repercussions for the government.
We may not actually see much outcome from this rapid movement at the moment, and I think that's how Anthony Albanese likes it. So I think in terms of, you know, how people think about Labor in a month's time, they'll be back to how we felt about Labor at the end of 2025.
Labor hopes to pass the gun control and hate speech laws today before the emergency sitting of Parliament is scheduled to end.
Political reporter Romy Stevens reporting there. Allegra Spender is the independent MP for Wentworth, which represents the Bondi community. I spoke to her earlier about this legislation. Allegra Spender, good morning. Thanks for joining us on AM today.
Thanks for having me.
From very early on, you called for amendments to the government's hate speech bill, calling for more protections for multiple minorities. Now, that hasn't been included, but we just heard that there has been a series of amendments. How does this hate speech package look to you now?
So I think that it is an important package. It is one on principle I will support. I obviously need to see the detail of any changes that have come in overnight. But I do believe that there is more work to be done, particularly in terms of addressing extremism. We know that Bondi was a crime of violent, in this case, Islamic extremism. And I think that there is work still to be done on things like vilification to really get to the heart of that extremism and stop before it turns into violence.
Without racial vilification laws, they were stripped out of this package. Do you think this legislation can deliver on its core promise to protect the Jewish community from anti-Semitism?
Look, I think it's going to take much more than one piece of legislation to protect the Jewish community from anti-Semitism. This is a long road. So I think that this really honestly is the start. And I think that we have, as a country, you know, there's going to be more legislative response that is really important and more policy response as well. And I think the Royal Commission is going to be critical to understanding really what happened in this particular case and how we can address this. So, you know, the work is not done after today. We have a long road ahead.
And the government has been criticised for rushing this legislation by the coalition, some community groups. Do you believe it was rushed, or was this speedy response needed?
I think we needed a speedy response, but I honestly think the consultation and the process has not been great, to be honest. I think this could have been handled better by the government. I also think they should have split the bills from the start, because that was, I think, political and unhelpful. But, you know, we are where we are with this legislation. And as I said, I do think it is important.
Do you think even an extra couple of weeks to talk to the community to get the consultation right would have made a difference?
Look, I think it would have in some cases of the legislation, or just, you know, a clearer consultation process really from the start. But again, I think we just have to accept that this is not the end of protections, and we shouldn't believe that it should be. So I think that we are going to have to keep that pressure on and to keep on considering what else can we do and what, you know, what other sort of approaches are really needed to keep the Jewish community safe, but frankly to keep our whole community safe and feeling like, you know, we're part of one country.
You brought up the Royal Commission that will look into this terror attack just before. Do you think we should be waiting for that Royal Commission to get the advice from that to forensically go through what happened before more policy is put forward, before there is more legislative response?
No, I think that there are some parts that we can do before then. And for instance, the response in relation to anti-Semitism, there has been a detailed report put forward by the anti-Semitism envoy. There are people like David Gonski, you know, committed to looking at parts of the education piece. So those parts are really critical. We can't wait till the Royal Commission to address, you know, the anti-Semitism, you know, that is across the country. So I do expect that, you know, we need to keep the pressure up in terms of, you know, policy responses. But the Royal Commission may deliver more.
And just finally, the National Day of Mourning will be on Thursday. How do you imagine your community will look and feel?
I think, and we are still devastated, and that doesn't go away. And I think the condolence motion yesterday, you know, Mark Dreyfus put it really beautifully, you know, when you lose someone, you know, it is, their loss is constant, and it's the presence, even as other people start to think of other things, your loss endures. So I think, you know, these pieces, these days of mourning, these moments are really important, but the support that the community will need, particularly the Jewish community will need, is ongoing on things like mental health support and other areas. So this is going to be a very, very hard time.
Allegra Spender, the independent member for Wentworth, thanks very much for your time this morning.
Thanks so much.
Now, the government's gun control laws look almost certain to pass Parliament today, but there could be challenges ahead in the rollout of this legislation. Among the reforms is a gun buyback scheme, which has already gotten pushback from Liberal-led states and territories. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Australians own more than 4 million firearms. It's a record for the country and an official figure released by the federal government as it tries to bring in tighter gun controls. The Public Health Association's acting CEO, Malcolm Baalman, argues the proposed laws must be supported by all sides of politics.
You know, the legendary basis of Australia's gun law reform from Port Arthur onwards is that bipartisanship is a good thing. It gives the nation a sense of security that all of our politicians will act together. There's no reason why that shouldn't apply in this bill before the Senate.
He's part of an alliance with other gun safety advocates who believe the changes will save lives.
So what's on the table in this bill is not the controversial elements of how many guns you can own and who can get a license and all of that. That is a matter for state and territory legislatures. The Commonwealth doesn't control that stuff. What's on the table for debate in the Senate in this occasion is about good housekeeping. It's about tightening up the import controls so that they match what guns are allowed to be had in Australia. It's about how the background checks are handled and how the security agencies do that.
The proposed laws will also set up a national gun buyback scheme. Sharing the cost of such a program has general support from states led by Labor, but it's been rejected by the Liberal-led Queensland, Tasmanian and Northern Territory governments. And their federal counterparts don't seem to be fans of the reforms either. Shadow Home Affairs spokesperson John O'Dunham speaking yesterday.
Of course, they've tied it in with a range of things that make that legislation unworkable. If there are changes, well, then maybe there's room to move. But at this point in time, I can't see how we could support them.
The gun control measures are set to pass with support from the Greens. In a statement, the National Farmers Federation says it supports the intention behind several elements of the bill, but that consultation and more time is needed to get it right and to make sure unintended impacts on farmers are avoided. Griffith University violence prevention expert Dr. Samara McFedrin also wants a more measured and considered process.
And one that gave sufficient time to everyone, including the Parliament itself, to really carefully think about these issues, to identify realistic and practical ways of addressing those problems, and to carefully draft legislation that focuses on key issues. Unfortunately, in this instance, I don't think that has occurred.
Dr. McFedrin has chaired the International Coalition for Women in Shooting and Hunting. Currently, she's not a member of any gun club or shooting organisation. She says Australia has a habit of quick fix responses, and it's not clear how some elements of these reforms will work in practice.
Measures that attempt to remove barriers to information sharing, they're quite reasonable, and we'd expect something like that to have a positive effect. But for other measures, it's unlikely that they'll have a significant impact on firearm misuse.
The federal government has repeatedly said that by strengthening gun laws and cracking down on hate speech, it deals with the motivation and the method behind the Bondi attack.
Bridget Fitzgerald and Isabel Misali reporting. A number of Sydney's beaches remain closed after a string of shark attacks in just over 24 hours. Two people have been seriously injured, including a 12-year-old swimmer who is in a critical condition in hospital. Experts believe at least one of the attacks was a bull shark, with heavy rainfall over the weekend luring them closer to shore. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
Three shark attacks in just 2 days has some swimmers along Sydney's coast on edge.
It's not okay being scared. There's too much culture in Australia based around the beach and it's our life.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. Like, it's never been like this, so I feel like we need to really get onto it and like start doing something about it because, yeah, it's too much.
The shark responsible for at least one of the attacks is suspected to be one of Australia's deadliest marine animals.
Bull sharks are one of three large species responsible for most serious bites and fatalities, the other two being the white shark and the tiger shark. Bull shark is one of the few shark species that will spend a significant period of time in rivers.
Dr. Daryl McPhee is an associate professor of environmental science at Bond University. He says there are several reasons why these animals are more active at this time of year.
It's the summer months, particularly January and February, where you expect to see more bull shark activity with the warm water and the food that's on offer. And bull sharks are very adept at hunting in murky water, particularly after rain. It's some of their preferred conditions. And that's the sort of conditions we've had in the Greater Sydney area over the last couple of days.
The first incident was in Sydney Harbour on Sunday. A 12-year-old boy was swimming with friends when he was attacked by what authorities believe was a large bull shark. He's now in a critical condition in hospital. The second was a few hours later. An 11-year-old was surfing at DY just a few kilometres away when he was knocked from his surfboard. He wasn't injured. The latest victim was a man in his 20s bitten yesterday evening at Manly Beach. He suffered serious injuries to his legs and was rushed to hospital. beaches along Sydney's northern coastline have been closed for 48 hours. Dr. Darren McPhee says a series of shark attacks in short succession is uncommon, but does happen, particularly after significant rainfall.
These clusters of bites do occur. Queensland experienced one, Inuit Sundays, South Africa has experienced them, Western Australia has experienced them, the Northern New South Wales has experienced them, and now we've seen the three bites. That always changes the public narrative because all of a sudden there appears to be a pattern of bites occurring, and it really does heighten people's fear of going in the water when you get these clusters of bites.
He warns those swimming need to be cautious of the dangers of murky water.
New South Wales government already invests significant money in shark bite mitigation, including education. I suspect increased drone patrols will be prudent for a period of time. A greater ramping up of education as well, because it's becoming quite clear that despite the existing educational material, there still does seem to be a gap in the public's thinking about going into those murky flood-affected waters, where we do know that bull shark risk, despite still being statistically low, is elevated in the short term. In general, if you're on a surf beach, you need to avoid murky water.
Dr. Darrell McPhee, an Associate Professor of Environmental Science at Bond University, ending Kathleen O'Connor's report. Russian President Vladimir Putin is one of around 60 world leaders that have been invited to join President Donald Trump's new Board of Peace. The group is being marketed as an international peacekeeping body, but some experts say it could threaten the United Nations Security Council. Bridget Rollison reports from Jerusalem.
US President Donald Trump has long been a critic of the United Nations.
The UN has such tremendous potential, but it's not even coming close to living up to that potential.
Now it seems that he's trying to set up his own peacekeeping organization to rival the UN.
This is a board like no other. It will have the heads of major countries.
The Board of Peace was first slated as part of Donald Trump's 20-point peace plan to end the war in Gaza, designed to oversee the reconstruction and governance of the Strip. But with no mention of Gaza in the board's draft charter, it's fueled speculation that it's being set up to resolve other world conflicts. Analyst at the International Crisis Group, Maya Unger, says the board is aimed at creating a US-dominated alternative to the United Nations.
I think many, especially here in New York, are quite concerned that this is an effort by the US administration to supersede the power and legitimacy of the Security Council, particularly as within the charter, it gives Donald Trump as the chairman power to essentially have a unilateral veto over any of these decisions.
Donald Trump has sent about 60 world leaders invitations to join the board, including Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who's considering the request. Also considering their invitation is the Russian President Vladimir Putin. One of the main intermediaries between Israel, the US and Hamas, Gershon Baskin, says if the board brings an end to the war in Ukraine, it could be a good thing.
But maybe Trump's thinking is that if we want to end the war in Ukraine, we need to bring Putin in. He has to be a partner. And again, everything will be judged by whether or not it succeeds. If the Board of Peace successfully brings an end to the war in the Ukraine, then it's a good thing. My major fear is that this new body is being constructed outside of the framework of international law.
Argentina, Hungary and Canada have already signed up. If members want to stay on the board longer than 3 years, they'll have to fork out $1.5 billion Australian dollars. Here's Maya Unger again.
You have this really interesting situation where Trump is asking countries to pay in for membership, but in fact, that doesn't change anything about the amount of power that they have within the system, and that still is going to rest with him and the United States first and foremost.
The Board of Peace is one of several committees Donald Trump has announced to carry out his peace plan in Gaza. About 80% of the buildings in the Palestinian territory have been damaged or destroyed, and many of its 2 million residents are still living in tents without basic healthcare and education. Whether the Board of Peace becomes a genuine mechanism for rebuilding Gaza or a parallel power structure challenging the UN remains to be seen. This is Bridget Rollison in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's become Donald Trump's latest obsession. The president is now slapping tariffs on European nations, pushing back against the idea that America should control Greenland. Today, the ABC's global affairs editor, Laura Tingle, on how the UK and Europe will respond and what it means for the future of NATO. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.